Hey, Talk Classic to Me listeners. So if you're anything like me, you need your morning coffee to function. But sometimes coffee just isn't enough. And if you're also like me, too much caffeine just makes you jittery and it doesn't really help you focus. Well, I have a solution for you and it's called Magic Mind. So, okay, ever since I started using Magic Mind, it has been so easy to incorporate into my morning routine. It tastes great, and it helps keep up my energy levels without getting too jittery or having that afternoon crash that you get when you just have coffee alone. So it's super easy to use. I just take this little shot of Magic Mind every morning alongside my first cup of coffee, and then I'm good to go for the rest of the day. It also improves my focus, and it makes my coffee last the whole day with no crash, seriously. And then I sleep better at night because it's not super heavy on caffeine. So that's great. Magic Mind has all natural ingredients, and it's sourced from the best suppliers that they could find, which means it's no sugar, nut-free, vegan, keto, paleo-friendly, and it contains matcha, which everybody knows is nature's extended-release caffeine. I didn't know that. That's why I said that, and it was funny. Caffeine from matcha apparently takes longer to release, and that helps reduce stress, so that's great. So if you're like me, and you don't love the afternoon caffeine crash with just coffee, I totally recommend you try this product. And where can you get it? Let me tell you. You can get it at magicmind.com/talkclassictome with the code TALKCLASSIC20. That's magicmind, magicmind.com/talkclassictome with the code TALKCLASSIC20. You also get up to 56% off with your first subscription or 20% off your one-time purchase. It also works if you're already a subscriber. You save on your next subscription payment, so that's awesome. You could already be a subscriber and still save. If you're having trouble being at 100% some days too, just like me, I would really encourage you to try it. And this company, Magic Mind, they're one of the few companies with a 100% money-back guarantee. No questions asked. There's really no risk. If you don't like it, they refund you in 3 to 4 hours. So try it out. It's www.magicmind.com/talkclassictome using the discount code TALKCLASSIC20 for up to 56% off your subscription. If I was you, I'd get the 30-pack because it's the best value. So again, check that out. And happy, healthy listening. Do you just love this podcast so much and wish you could find a way to monetarily support us? Well, guess what? Much like NPR, we thrive on support from viewers like you. So if you love this podcast and you want to become a contributor, all you have to do is go to anchor.fm. That's ANCHOR.FM. Click the support button and choose the amount that you want to contribute each month to our podcast. This helps keep our podcast going, and it keeps the phenomenal content that you have come to know and love flowing. So yeah, what are you waiting for? Sign up today. As always, thank you so much for being a listener. We appreciate you. We see you. And we hope you enjoy the show. Welcome to Talk Classic to Me, the classic film podcast and movie club where I, Sarah Greenfield, your host and classic film enthusiast, bring in my entertaining friends to talk about classic movies or any other old-fashioned form of media that strikes my fancy, except today, because everyone at home, we have such a special guest. George Stevens Jr. is on our show today. He is an author, a playwright, a director, a producer, the founder of the American Film Institute, and one of the creators of the Kennedy Center Honors. We are so honored to have him, and we're chatting about his life and his new book called My Place in the Sun. So sit back and enjoy this wonderful interview with the incredible George Stevens Jr. Welcome to Talk Classic to Me. I am your host, Sarah Greenfield, and today on the show, we have a very special returning guest. Please welcome writer, director, producer, founder of AFI, the American Film Institute, one of the creators of the Kennedy Center Honors, and author of My Place in the Sun, George Stevens Jr. Welcome back to the show, George. It is such a pleasure to see you again. Thank you for being here.
Well, I'm so happy to talk with you, Sarah.
Yeah, it's great to have you. We last spoke in 2022 before your book came out. And listeners, I highly encourage you to check out that interview because George Stevens Jr. is a fantastic guest. He is so gracious and so engaging, and he has these incredible stories that are worth hearing. So please check out that episode. But since we last spoke in 2022, you've been able to share your fantastic book, My Place in the Sun, available wherever you get your books, with the world. What are some of the responses you've received about the book, and what has it meant to you to be able to share your story?
Well, also since 2022, I have recorded the book. So now it is available for people who enjoy to listen to books on Spotify or wherever one looks for recorded books.
Can I tell you, that's how I read your book, and it was lovely because you can hear the love in your voice when you talk about your family and just the people that you love. So I highly recommend listening to the audiobook.
Oh my gosh, thank you, Sarah. Well, it's been a wonderful experience. You write something like this, and then to get a response is so interesting. People, seem to be interested in the stories and also interested in the larger ideas. So, to talk with people about it, is a great experience, and I feel very good that I've written it down, and it's one place, and it also gives me kind of a perspective on my own life that is beyond just the writing about it. It's good in every respect for me.
I love that. I mean, I didn't expect the recurring themes between your father's life and your own life, and his lessons of things standing the test of time. So I do want to break down for people at home who might not know, for listeners who might not know, you come from a golden age of Hollywood family. Your dad is Oscar-winning film director George Stevens. I mean, come on. He directed indelible film classics like A Place in the Sun, Giant, Shane, The Diary of Anne Frank, Gunga Din, Swing Time, The More the Merrier, the list goes on. I loved this book, and I felt like it was such a love letter to your family, even beyond your father. And you really weave your their stories into your own. Was there anything that you discovered about your family while researching the book that was a surprise to you? Or where was there a particular story you were very proud of to share about your family?
I learned a great deal because when I was growing up, we weren't looking back as much as we do today. And you weren't kind of, at least in my world, we were thinking about family or talking about that much. And my mother, who was kind of an archivist of her own, kept, and I when she died, there were three big boxes, huge boxes, with full of clippings from my grandparents' theater work, and my great grandmother, a wonderful article on her. So I really had this discovery at a time when it probably meant more to me than it would have when I was young,
Yeah.
of this extraordinary family. The pioneer of which was my grandmother, my great grandmother, Georgia Woodthorpe, who was an actress in San Francisco. And she started as a little girl in an acting company that where a great one of the great dramatists, the actor, director, asked her to join his company at age six. And among her accomplishments or claims to fame is that she is the youngest Ophelia to Edwin Booth, the great Shakespearean, our greatest Shakespearean, to his Hamlet, that she acted with him and wrote about it and talked about it. Her daughter, Georgie Woodthorpe, married a man called Lander Stevens, and they were the parents of my father. So, and then my mother's mother, Alice Howell, was a silent film star. She was in the first four films that Charlie Chaplin made, starred with him, and then made 100 silent comedies of her own. So for me, just kind of that having that discovery, organizing it into a story is one of the rewards of of having done the book.
I do want to give a shout out to your grandmother, Alice Howell, who I didn't know much about before reading your book. And I was thrilled to hear that four of her films have been recovered because a lot of her films had been lost because of nitrate film being highly flammable and not easy to store. So yeah, she was this silent era film comedian who Stan Laurel ranked among his top 10 comedic performers. I learned that from you. And then there was also a great story in the book about Gracie Allen recognizing your mother when you all went out to dinner. I loved that story. So yeah,
Yeah.
this book has it all. So you come from a line of performers. Even your dad acted for a while as a teen. What made you realize that that was not the track for you?
I never really considered it. I wasn't just inclined that way. So it was never, there was a time when I was running the American Film Institute, and I got a telegram from Francis Coppola, who was in the Philippines making Apocalypse Now. And it seems that an actor from New York couldn't get his shots and get to the Philippines to do a very important scene in the picture. And Francis said, "I want you to read the script. You only would appear in one scene, but it's a pivotal scene. It can't be cut from the picture. It is the scene where a sort of figure, kind of a perhaps a CIA man, tells the young officer that he wants him to go to Northern Vietnam and terminate Colonel Kurtz with extreme prejudice." And that is the part that Marlon Brando plays. So it's kind of the linchpin to the whole thrust of the movie. And so I flew to the Philippines, and I worked with Francis and Vittorio Storaro, the great cameraman. And Francis never liked to move the camera much, but Vittorio liked moving the camera, and Francis gotten to like it. And I thought he'd shoot the scene and cut it into close-ups and make it easy, but no, it was Vittorio moving the camera. But anyway, I managed to do it with Harvey Keitel, who was the lead, and I got back to Los Angeles, had a wonderful letter from Francis that he really loved the way the scene turned out and all. 2 weeks later in Variety, I saw some kind of a headline: Francis Coppola shaves his beard, does this and this, and fires Harvey Keitel. So it meant that my trip to the Philippines, that we shot a scene that's not going to be anywhere. And so I kind of accepted that. And I don't know, Francis, I don't think he asked me to go back to the Philippines, but I would not have. I'd invested enough time in this. But that's really the extent of my acting career. But I do narrate films, and I narrate this book. So I'm
Yes.
not totally divorced from it.
And I would say you are a good public speaker as well. You're able to express yourself in such a way where people are entertained and understand you. So I think that that's all that really matters at the end of the day. So you brought all of those things up, and I was reading your book just thinking, this man's life is like Forrest Gump, except for he's not hapless at all. You've seen all these incredible moments. I mean, like you held Anne Frank's diary. You drove in the car with James Dean that would eventually like lead to his tragic end. You had your honeymoon partly in Moscow and partly on Sam Spiegelman's yacht in Monte Carlo, because you had to go, do a film festival in Moscow. Like, when these things in your life are happening, are you aware that this is just absolutely incredible and not normal? And do you appreciate all of these kind of random but wonderful occurrences that have happened in your life?
Yes, I think you appreciate many of them. I mean, certainly meeting Otto Frank, Anna Frank's father, having him put the diary in my hands was something I knew how extraordinary that was. But until you kind of start and you put them into a book, you don't realize how many there are. And it's why I was hesitant at first to write the book, but then once I got into it and had reaction to people who were, would read it as I was going along, it seemed to become obvious that I've had a very blessed life. And I did realize when I'd finished writing the book that probably the thing that makes mine and my wife Elizabeth's lives so unusual is the people who've populated it, that we've just been blessed with knowing and working with people from not just from the movies, but from, with the Kennedy Center Honors, from ballet and classical music and rock music, and people in politics and sports. Muhammad Ali pops up in my life. So yes, I was blessed, and I appreciate it.
Well, that does lead me back to my next question, which is, so your dad is this world-class director, and you have this very unusual childhood where you grow up in Toluca Lake. Johnny Weissmuller rescued you from drowning when you were a little boy. Your friends in high school were Buck Henry and Robert Wagner. You got to be on Hollywood movie sets with glamour and celebrity, but you managed to stay grounded and down to earth. How did that happen? How did you avoid the Hollywood trap of malaise and discontent? And do you think that's a testament to how you were raised?
I do. I was going to say that my mother, you'll find a good deal of her in the book, and she was really wonderful. And my father was away at war for 3 years when I was from 13 to 16. So during the war, and she worked at the, I think it was called the Birmingham Hospital in Van Nuys as a nurse's aide during the war. Worked in the burn unit. And so I was blessed with that and a father who had his very much had his head in the right place and his feet on the ground. So, because there are so many stories of sons of famous figures and producers and directors who had difficult lives, and I didn't.
You also seem to have a good head on your shoulders. I mean, you made it out of that system that could have really torn you down. So that's an incredible accomplishment. This is just a silly question because I loved it in the book. But the last time you were here on this show, I mentioned that I'm a big fan of The More the Merrier. Would you please tell my listeners the story about your first time at the Academy Awards when you were 12 and you went on behalf of your father?
Yes, well, I was not a big movie fan when I was a young. I was a baseball fan. I wanted to be a sports writer. That was my goal in life as I've been through my teen years. And it, one night, the best things were what they called twi-night double headers. The first game started at 5 o'clock, and then, there'd be two games, and there was a twi-night double header between the Hollywood Stars, my team, and the San Francisco Seals that I was greatly looking forward to. And my mother said, "Well, no," she said, "there's something else. We have to go. Your father's been nominated for an Academy Award. He'd won the New York Critics Award for Best Director of 1943. And he was now nominated for the award for Best Directing." And I didn't follow the Academy Awards. I mean, they weren't on television and all. But anyway, I went with my mother and my grandmother. And we sat, I remember we sat with the nominees for Best Actress, Jennifer Jones and Jean Arthur and Ingrid Bergman. And my mother remembered that when Ingrid Bergman's film would win for Best Art Direction, the other actresses would applaud, graciously. And Mark Sandrich was a fine director of the period. And he came out on the stage to present the award for Best Director. And he read the nominations and he opened the envelope and he said, "Michael Curtiz, Casablanca." Well, my mother said that I had a kind of a big voice for a young boy. And sort of in that quiet after the before the applause or after the applause, I said, "We was robbed," and it echoed through. And the gracious ladies, my mother said, were all in hysterics. They thought it was so funny. But anyway, so I went and of course Casablanca was a worthy winner.
That's a great moment. Oh, I love that story so much. Thank you for sharing it here again. So I think one of my favorite things about your book, just as a big classic movie fan, was reading about the on-set stories, specifically from A Place in the Sun and Shane and Giant. Those stories really shared, what it's like, the craft behind filmmaking.
No.
Were you aware in those moments during the shooting that what you were witnessing was greatness and craft? And what did you take away from those experiences on those sets and apply to your own career?
Yeah, no, I definitely did. I mean, and to be around my father on a movie set, you just felt it, you know, such being in charge, knowing what he wanted, ambitious, looking for ways to make it extraordinary, the performances and everything. And so one thing I took away from it, and I used to say with some irony that I might spend my entire life devoted to becoming the second best film director in my family. There became a change where I did other things in addition to directing. So I think I still qualify as the second best film director in my family, but I've made, you know, contributed in other ways. But yeah, to be around and see how decisions are made and how people are handled and how actors are handled. I remember before when I was in college, I visited the set at Paramount Pictures where he was making A Place in the Sun with Elizabeth Taylor, Montgomery Clift, and Shelley Winters. And on a Saturday, I went to the studio and went on the sound stage, and they were all there working and they were starting a new scene. And Elizabeth came in, you know, and I looked and saw the most beautiful woman on the planet. And then Montgomery Clift, rather attractive individual himself. And that had me, I guess they introduced me somewhere along the way. And then when they got ready to work, he said, "Well, okay, Monty, why don't you go in the set there? And why don't you find a place near the pool table? And Elizabeth, why don't you start over by the door? And why don't you just run the scene?" And so, and they had the script supervisor was there to help them with lines because, you know, they've just learned the script. And they did it and they went all the way through it. And he said, "Oh, okay, that's very nice. And why don't you do it? Let's do it one more time." And so they did it again. And then he said, "Yeah, well, good. I think you're getting there. Just try it again." And so they went through the scene again. And at the end, Monty came over to him, you know, and very intense and started asking him a question. And then Elizabeth came over and they talked. And then they started working with the scene and got it shaped up, you know. And then he said, "Okay, the cameraman go in and light the set and all." And I was talking with him later. And I said, "Dad," I said, "you know, I don't understand. You had them go through that three times without any, just not saying anything. Why did you do it that way? Why did you wait?" And he said, "Sometimes it's useful for actors to discover that they may need some help, rather than going in and saying, 'No, Monty, why don't you do it this way?' Or 'Elizabeth, you let them feel it their way, and then when you start to help them, they'll be more receptive."
Yes, I come from an acting background. That's, I got my degree and I was classically trained in theater. And I think also doing that, he creates this environment that feels a little more collaborative and he's not going to micromanage you, right?
Yeah.
You can explore different options
Right.
without feeling like you're going to be completely crushed. So yeah,
Right.
I loved hearing that story. And I also loved, ooh, hearing how he stood up for his actors that were very professional on set. There was that story about Mercedes McCambridge, who had kind of suffered an injury the day before and was going to show up the next day on set. She shows up on time, ready to shoot. Her makeup is covering up her injuries, and James Dean was late. And your father politely but firmly said, "You need to apologize to Mercedes McCambridge. She was here on time, and we were waiting for you." I loved that story. Because I love James Dean, but I also get frustrated by, especially having come from an acting background, I get frustrated by actors who kind of maybe pretend that they're using the craft, but utilize that for bad behavior, like to excuse bad behavior. So I loved hearing that story. And that you also discussed casting in your book. I was shocked to learn that Montgomery Clift was up to play Shane, and that William Holden was up to play the homesteader whose name I can't remember right now.
Joe Starrett.
Joe Starrett, that's right. I was so surprised to learn that. And then there were other casting decisions, like Audrey Hepburn potentially could have been in Giant, Grace Kelly could have been in Giant, Robert Mitchum. There were all these names. I was just so surprised to learn, and I thought what different films these would be. There's not really a question here. I just love that information. I guess it's that casting is so fickle, and things could be so different with different actors in these roles. How do you move forward, essentially, when maybe you don't get the actor that you thought you would have?
No, I think the lesson from the first is that Paramount Pictures were very happy to have Holden and Monty Clift, and then Monty Clift kind of changed his mind, and then Holden said, "Well, God, if Monty's not doing it, you know." Anyway, the two of them went away, and so Paramount was going to postpone the picture, and my father waited a day or two and then went over to Y. Frank Freeman, the head of production of Southern Gentleman, who my father came to refer to as Y. Frank Freeman with a question mark. And he sat down, and Freeman started to talk about how sorry he was, but we just can't go ahead. And Dad said, "Well, you have that list of commitments you have from actors in your left-hand drawer. We've seen it before. Why don't you let me look at that list?" And Freeman kind of reluctantly took the list out of his drawer and handed it to my father. And he went down the list and he said, "Oh," he said, "Alan Ladd." He said, "Alan Ladd could play this part." And a little farther down, he saw Jean Arthur for the woman. He said, "Jean Arthur's never the more the merrier, talk of the town." He said, "She's never let me down." And she was 40 years old with gray hair. She doesn't have gray hair, too old for the part, other than being a wonderful actress. And then Van Heflin, he said, "I've saw him in that Jim Bridger movie." And he recast the movie in 5 minutes. But I mean, that, confidence and casting is so important, because casting really does define the film. He had the confidence in himself, and Frank Freeman kind of saw his confidence and decided to go along, and it proved to be the most successful picture Paramount had made up to that time. So it was a good thing for everyone.
And it's hard to imagine that role with anyone but Alan Ladd. But then I could also imagine it with Montgomery Clift. But Alan Ladd is perfect. Ah, oh, you go back and forth.
And the actors change it, I mean,
Yeah.
that Jean Arthur was so wonderful because she was a little older, and so true. And so casting is very important.
A thread that I was noticing a lot. So I feel like last time we talked about work standing the test of time, but something else I was noticing was this strong sense of justice that parallels kind of between your life and your father's life. There was a story that really struck me that I hadn't heard before. Your father standing up to Cecil B. DeMille in the Directors Guild during the McCarthy era. I hadn't heard the story, and I didn't realize how underhanded that situation was. and how your dad won this brief victory against McCarthyism. Can you speak a little bit to that? And then how having that thread of a sense of justice appears in your own work. And I'm particularly thinking about your work about Thurgood Marshall and your documentaries for USIA.
Right. Well, my father was a strong influence, and I saw him well beyond draft age. I realized later, volunteer to go to war. He was a great force at the Directors Guild, and you mentioned this Cecil B. DeMille episode, which is a story you will enjoy reading, but it's too long
Yes.
to tell
Yeah.
this time. But it was basically he saw this misuse of kind of the loyalty oath and things by Cecil B. DeMille to really take over the guild. And he fought against that and really ended the McCarthyism that was latent in the Directors Guild. And then I worked with him on the Diary of Anne Frank, which was such a story of the human condition and injustice. So I think it led me in a direction where I was always ready. And when I went to USIA later to work in Washington in the Kennedy administration with Edward R. Murrow heading the motion picture division of USIA, I was inclined to make films that showed our quest for social justice. One was called Nine from Little Rock about the students who went into Little Rock High School. A documentary that was called Nine from Little Rock actually won the Academy Award. And then later, the march with Martin Luther King. And then later in my own creative life, I did the miniseries Separate but Equal with Sidney Poitier and Burt Lancaster. And later wrote a play in which Sidney portrayed Thurgood Marshall on the story of Brown versus the Board of Education that ended segregation in public schools. And then I wrote a play about Thurgood Marshall. I was raised in a family that understood tolerance and empathy and equal opportunity. So I had some good guidance.
And I had mentioned this last time, but I have to tell you again, we watched Nine from Little Rock in my high school. It's still being shown today as an example of what was happening in the past. I don't know. It's such a prolific work. So thank you for making that. So there's a famous saying, never meet your heroes, but it seems to me like you met them and it went pretty great. What was it? Do you think that made those legends, like working with Edward R. Murrow or any of the other legends you've worked with, what made them so wonderful to work with?
Well, I think that people have lots of stories about their terrible bosses. I had very few bosses in my life. Jack Webb, who did Dragnet, was he gave me a job when I came out of the Air Force, and he was a tough guy, but a nice guy, and he really kind of tolerated me. I was young and headstrong, that he gave me a directing job when I was 25. Then to work with Edward R. Murrow, he's just one of the great people of that century. And it's not hard to do the right thing when you're working with somebody. He had tremendous integrity. And then, President Kennedy, that I was not working directly for him, but his thoughts and his ideas, and I did have contact with him. And he had these wonderful, he wrote wonderful speeches and had pieces written for him, but he loved the ancient Greeks. And he had a quote that I wrote down: "The Greek definition of happiness is the fullest use of one's powers along lines of excellence," having that opportunity. And I realized that I was making 300 documentaries a year, under Ed Murrow, working with President Kennedy in the New Frontier, and that I was living the Greek definition of happiness, seeking to make excellent films. That's the use of the fullest use of one's powers along lines of excellence. I was blessed to really work with wonderful people. And then when I came in contact with actors like Sidney Poitier, we were friends before he agreed to play a role in Separate But Equal, in the miniseries that won the Emmy for the best miniseries. Such a gift working with Sidney. Although I had seen Sidney and admired him in The Heat of the Night and The Defiant Ones and The Blackboard Jungle, and he was just that power and dignity. And I had not seen the films he'd made with Bill Cosby, the comedies. And so when we were working on Separate But Equal, he's playing Thurgood Marshall, we had an early scene where he was in South Carolina, and he talked to the people in the church down there and said if they'd get a petition of 40 people, he would make their city a case, their school a case in Brown versus the Board of Education. And he was so powerful in that scene. Then he came back to New York to the NAACP headquarters late, and there was a poker game going on among the lawyers, about three or four of them. And Sidney comes in and sits down with the lawyers in the poker game. And in it, he's going to tell them what they're going to do in South Carolina with this school desegregation case. And I'm seeing him do it, and they're dealing and playing cards. And Sidney's kind of very light and doing, and it just didn't seem like the Sidney I knew. And so I arranged to change the lights or something and took Sidney aside. We ended up walking into a room full of props and lamps, and we're just the two of us standing there. And I said, "Sidney, I'm not quite sure what we're doing in this scene." And I just saw those black eyes gazing at me, and I started to say, "Oh my God, I don't think I'm doing this quite the right way." And I stopped, and he stopped for a moment, and he said to me, "Why don't you tell me what you expect?" And I don't know where it came from, but I looked him in the eye and I said, "Sidney," I said, "I think of Thurgood Marshall as a man with secrets." And Sidney said, "Whenever you want that, just say that word." And from then on, our collaboration was, from my standpoint, perfect.
Oh my God, what an incredible story. Thank you for sharing that with us. So I told my mom that you were coming back on the show, and she said you did not ask him about the Kennedys enough last time. So
Oh.
please, for the love of God, ask him about the Kennedys. You knew the Kennedys. You worked on a documentary about Jackie Kennedy's trip to Asia. My mom would be furious if I did not ask, what were they like? What were the Kennedys like? Can you describe the impression that they left with you? What was it like to be in their presence? These are the questions my mom needs answered.
Oh, well, they influenced a change in my life. I mean, to come to Washington, I think I had kind of high aspirations for movies, but I just sensed from President Kennedy, his voice, his manner, his leadership, it was inspiring. And he made you believe anything was possible. Just one of his quotations, "I look forward to an America that will not be afraid of grace and beauty, that will recognize achievement in the arts the way we recognize achievement in statecraft or business." I started the Kennedy Center Honors. The idea of the Kennedy Center Honors is in that sentence, which is carved in the walls of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington. So, I mean, that's just one of the kind of influences. I mean, he just he raised my sights and stimulated in me a broader appreciation of the arts than I would otherwise have had. And, you know, he was not a devotee of classical music or the opera, but he knew it was important. In fact, Jackie used to tease him that his favorite song was Hail to the Chief. But the Kennedy Center Honors would not exist had I not been influenced by him. And he also was not so deadly serious a person. The last time I spoke with him was an early morning phone call where he reached me on Eastern time, not thinking perhaps, or not having to think that it was 6 o'clock in the morning in Los Angeles. And the call came, and I picked it up out of my sleep, and he said, "George," and we had made a film that he admired greatly called The Five Cities of June, a documentary which included his trip to Berlin. He said, "I think you ought to see that Five Cities of June is nominated for an Academy Award." And then in the Oval Office, he went back to dealing with Cuba or whatever was on his menu. So, and then Jackie also, you know, Liz and I were good friends with her. Just such a remarkable woman. You know, you would think that she was 34 when her husband died, and the grace with which she led a nation through that 4 day weekend and the aftermath of it. And then Bobby and Ethel, just two of the greatest people you would ever want to know. And Bobby, I believe, ironically, that his death, I think, was an even greater tragedy than Jack's, because Bobby was the one who could bring us back from Jack's death. But again, Bobby's influence, you know, some people see things that they are and say, "Why?" Others say, "Why not?" And, you know, just that sense that things were possible, I took from the Kennedys.
Oh, that's wonderful.
If you think my comments on the Kennedys were worthwhile, I think then your mother should take you out for a very nice dinner.
Oh, that would be nice. Mom, did you hear that? The Kennedy Center Honors have been such a mainstay in the American lexicon. Can you describe for our listeners how they came about and what you hope their legacy will be?
Yes, I started long ago making a list at the end of each year of what might happen in the next year, what I should do and what I might do. And I had on that list for some time command performance at the Kennedy Center. I mean, you know, in England they have the Queen's, you know, the command performance. And I just thought a gala at the Kennedy Center. And then I realized that it should be a celebration of the great figures in the performing arts. And we did the 10th anniversary of the American Film Institute in the Kennedy Center Opera House. And we had a thing about the greatest 100 films and a White House reception that President and Mrs. Carter gave beforehand, and all sorts of stars came to Washington and filmmakers. And it was a wonderful event, a White House reception, and this event at the Kennedy Center broadcast on CBS. And the next morning, I walked down to a man named Roger Stevens, no relation, who ran the Kennedy Center. He was a Broadway producer. He bought the Empire State Building one afternoon. Extraordinary man. And I thanked him for letting us use the Opera House. It put AFI on the map nationally, this broadcast. And then I said, I think you ought to have your own event. And he said, do you have any IDs? Which is sort of his way of saying that word. And I said, I do. And I said, it is carved on the wall of this building. And he said, what is it? And I recited the Kennedy quote, I look forward to an America that will not be afraid of grace and beauty and that will honor achievement in the arts. And I said, that's the idea, that we do an annual gala, have a reception at the White House, and celebrate, I would say, five great figures in the performing arts. And that's how the idea came. And Roger said, good, why don't you see if you can put it together? And I did.
What do you hope the legacy of the Kennedy Center Honors will be? What do you hope to see from it in the future?
Well, in doing it, I felt that one, to create a legacy where these individuals' lives are remembered, and they're remembered in an artful and distinguished way. The first honorees in that first year were Arthur Rubinstein, Marian Anderson, George Balanchine, Richard Rodgers of Rodgers and Hammerstein, and Fred Astaire. And we kept the level of those artists. And I did it with Nick Vanoff in the first instance and with my son Michael later for 37 years. And in the Kennedy Center, David Rubenstein, who's chairman of it, very effective as chairman, decided they wanted to go in a different direction. So it has gone in a different direction. We had an audience of 9.4 million when we left. Last year's audience was 3.6 million. So I don't know if it will be able to restore itself. A very key component in what when we were doing it were the film biographies. You have Marian Anderson, Arthur Rubinstein, the five I mentioned. An audience comes into the Kennedy Center on the night, and there will be an audience that comes together on CBS 10 days later. They come, maybe some of them know, probably all of them know about Fred Astaire. Some of them know about Marian Anderson. Classical music people know Arthur Rubinstein. People know about Oklahoma, but they don't know about Richard Rodgers. But we made these biographical films. And the first honoree at the Kennedy Center in that first year was Marian Anderson. And Harry Belafonte came out and spoke about her. And then the screen, the lights came down, and we had a movie screen. It was like the Radio City Music Hall. It was not little monitors. And the room was dark, and people were there in the dark with Marian Anderson's story of how she learned to sing in Philadelphia. And you hear that voice in great sound and see her story. And then you learn that she is supposed to sing at Constitution Hall. And the daughters of the American Revolution, who own Constitution Hall, rejected her because of her race. And Eleanor Roosevelt arranged for Marian Anderson instead to sing on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial on Easter Sunday to a crowd of 300,000 people. And you hear her voice singing, My Country, 'Tis of Thee. Well, people were so moved. I mean, it was a movie that really brings you to tears in 5 minutes. And then when the lights came up, people stood and they turned and they applauded her in the box, And we had not anticipated that. And of course, for every honoree since, while we were doing the show, after that film, people stood and turned to the box and saluted the honorees, you know, and they no longer have the biographical films. I think it was such an important core to bring the audience together. I can only speak for the very wonderful and happy 37 years that we did. And I don't have any really influence over its future.
Well, it sounds to me like the legacy that you would want for it is to be able to share not just why these artists are important, but the stories behind them. You want to be able to connect the audience with the importance of the artist and what they brought and what they accomplished. So it sounds like that was what you were hoping to do as
Yeah.
well as
And it
honor
was so
artists.
interesting. We actually it became kind of we became self-conscious about it, but so many of the early Arthur Rubinstein, for example, and Aaron Copland and so many others fled Europe, you know, when the Nazis took power. And we have to be careful. We say can't use that Nazi flag in the same way, because we were telling the lives of these artists are journeys. And we were really telling that journey in 5 minutes to both move the audience, and then whatever tribute we did had more meaning because the tribute would refer to what we saw in the film.
So I do want to change tracks and talk about AFI,
Yeah.
the American Film Institute. AFI is really meaningful to me because that was my first big internship in graduate school. And I worked in their archive, and their archivist, Emily Wittenberg, is my mentor to this day.
Of course, Emily Wittenberg, she's really terrific.
She's the best.
Yeah.
She really has been in my corner the whole way and has given me so much guidance. And I got to work with all of these different archival components, but something that was very special that I got to work with, actually two things. One, I loved working with the photos of the AFI Achievement Awards. They were fantastic. William Wyler's especially, I remember just geeking out over getting to work with those. But the oral histories were incredible. You fostered this legacy of preservation, and we get to hear through time, like artists and work cultivating. So I was wondering if you ever had the opportunity to go back and listen to some of the oral histories and seminars, and if there was ever a visiting artist or fellow that stuck out to you during your time at AFI.
AFI mentorship. You know, I had this mentorship with my father, in another way with Ed Murrow. You know, not about just about leadership. You know, that was a the, by his manner, the way he dealt with people. True also of my father, but so I believe in that, and that AFI Conservatory. Which we started in 1969, and the four of the there were 12 fellows, as we call them, just to name Terrence Malick, David Lynch was actually the second year, Paul Schrader, Caleb Deschanel, I mean today Patty Jenkins, there are so many that have come. I don't want to go start a list. But giving people the opportunity to learn. And it's not just when they come to the AFI, they learn. The great filmmakers come and talk and do seminars, but they meet colleagues. And so many, Ed Zwick and Marshall Herskowitz, you know, met at AFI, and they end up starting a film company. And, you know, people, more and more, you just see people with their colleagues from AFI. So that is one of the pleasures of it, and the fact that it has stood the test of time. They're now 50 years the conservatory has been alive and functioning. So that's sort of a omelet of a few thoughts about your questions.
Ah, what a special place you have built. It was such an honor to get to work there and to see it exist. Like, as an archivist, I was like, this place is wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, we really did have a concept when we started AFI. The foundation of it was film preservation. Over half of the films that had been made up till 1967, when we started AFI, had been lost or were missing. And our first thrust was to address that. And we made an alliance with the Library of Congress, and we, AFI, went and found the films and would bring libraries of films, individual films. There are 42,000 films in the AFI collection in the Library of Congress. So that was important. And the echoes of that, because when people go to the conservatory, they see the classic films. All of this is intertwined. And it's nice that the institution, Bob Ghazaly, leads it today. It's a very has a good deal of foresight and energy and skill, and doing a fine job. So it's nice to see, because again, in the Kennedy spirit of things, it's things that last, you know, and high aspiration, excellence, but that they live through time.
I also want to let you know when I was listening to the oral histories, one of my favorite ones, this is a callback to earlier, Sidney Poitier had an incredible seminar. He put everything out on the table. He talked about his life, he talked about his craft. And it was several parts. I think it was like a four-parter. But his is one of the interviews that really stuck out to me as something incredibly special. And I felt grateful that I got to listen to it.
A nice connection to that is, I did two books. One, Conversations with the Great Filmmakers of Hollywood's Golden Age, based on the seminars. I wrote profiles of the directors, and then we edited the seminars, included them, and it starts with Harold Lloyd, who was the first, but then includes William Wyler, Billy Wilder, my father, John Huston, Raoul Walsh, Fellini, Bergman, and then a second volume that includes Sidney Poitier and people of a younger generation, Alan Pakula, no, Nora Ephron, Meryl Streep. So there are these two books that contain those, some of the best of those seminars.
So, you have met just so many famous historical figures, Hollywood figures. Was there anyone that you didn't meet that you wish you had?
Well, gosh, you know, I've never really thought about it that way. I mean, I feel so blessed by how many I have met and know.
So, I guess, was there a surprising interaction with a living legend that was unexpected?
Oh, well, lots. And there are combinations, three cushion shots. When I was at Paramount, Carl Sandburg, the great historian, poet, one of the great figures of the century. He was 86 and had this white hair and wonderful, wonderful figure. And Marilyn Monroe wanted to meet him. And so it became my job to take Marilyn to meet Carl. And, you know, that was so special. And he really lit up to charm her and she him. So, yes, it's a pleasure just to have that experience of people that you enjoy, you know.
And I guess essentially, as a producer, maybe you're a little bit of a moderator. You can work with and talk to anyone. So you get to be kind of used in that capacity with different people. You have such a vast legacy. You have done so much in your life and your career. What do you think is your proudest accomplishment? And is there anything that you'd still like to achieve?
Oh, yes, I have things that we're working on, but I think my most satisfying single accomplishment is making a movie called George Stevens, A Filmmaker's Journey. It's a movie I made about my father, a feature-length movie, which turned out to be awfully, awfully good, if I do say so, because it has stood the test of time. We are just now doing a 4K remastering of it, because for films to really last, they need to be in 4K. And we're at work on that right now. But being able to, we premiered it at the Deauville Festival, and I wasn't sure how good it was going to be, because I hadn't seen it with an audience. But when we showed it at the Deauville Festival, and Thomas Quinn Curtis wrote in the International Herald Tribune that it was the great surprise of the festival and all, and the audience responded. So, you know, to be able to do that about the father you love, and you know, that's tremendously satisfying. You know, and I've taken real satisfaction out of my creative work, but I guess, you know, to have been able to establish the American Film Institute, and to establish the Kennedy Center Honors, to do those things in the public sphere that are broader than my own work, they count high in my list of satisfactions.
Yeah. So what's next? What do you still hope to achieve next?
Well, I don't want to be specific, but I'm working on a couple of projects that I think are worthwhile.
Well, I thank you for being here. I do have some very silly questions. There's this book called All About Me from 1998 that has great conversation questions that are kind of fun to ask people now. All right, so here are some of the questions from this silly book, All About Me. Do you like to cook?
Not seriously.
All right. Can you remember jokes? Are you good at telling jokes?
I don't remember. I don't like telling jokes. I like telling stories.
Do you like being on the phone?
It's fine.
Do you run late or do you run early?
I've medium.
Medium. Yeah. Do you read the newspaper every day?
Yes.
Yes. Can you whistle?
Not to any distinctive purpose.
Do you generally save letters and postcards?
Yes.
When you think you've done something wrong, are you quick to apologize?
I rarely do anything wrong.
That's a good answer. Do you like parties or do you hate parties?
I think I liked parties more when I was younger. I like now kind of small dinners.
Yeah, I think for me, it depends on what the party is. You know, parties is such a broad term. All right, two more questions. Do you enjoy being photographed?
I don't mind.
And do you think life treats you well?
Life has treated me much better than I deserve.
Oh, I don't know about that. I feel like I didn't do your book justice. I just want to say to you, your book is incredible. I loved your book. I think for listeners at home, first of all, if you love classic film, just go out and buy the book anyway. But I was just so moved by your book. I felt like you included so much in such a respectful way. So it's this book that's respectful, but still very personal. And I could genuinely feel the love that you have for the people in your life. So for me, it's such an honor to speak with you. So anyway, I loved reading your book. I'm so grateful that we have it. People, please go out and buy My Place in the Sun. Thank you. And everyone at home, we'll see you next time on Talk Classic to Me.
You have been listening to Talk Classic to Me with Sarah Greenfield. That's me. My guest this week was the legendary George Stevens Jr., who was so generous to come on our show. They will also be featured on our Instagram page. If you enjoyed our show, please introduce a friend and show them how to subscribe, and maybe even find us on anchor.fm to become a contributing member. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Talk Classic to Me for some awesome content and to find out what's coming up next. Thanks for listening.